I will reconvene the online learning task force for September 2nd, 2009. We had recessed right before lunch, and we were upstairs looking at demonstrations from a number of virtual charter schools providers and actually curriculum providers. We're going to go back to our agenda, move around a little bit. We'll go, obviously, to the online learning issues state overview from Jan McComb, but then we'll come back for the overview of the task force work plan, and then we'll go to the final item on the agenda. So, would you introduce?
I will. Jan McComb is with us. She's staff of the State Board of Education. She's got a little PowerPoint.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Devlin, members of the task force. As Dana just said, I help staff the State Board of Education. The State Board spent a lot of time on this topic, as you may know. Your earlier presenter quoted Emerson, and to not be outdone, I would also like to quote Emerson, who said, among other things, nothing is more vulgar than haste. Now, I think if Emerson were alive today, he might rethink that. But if I skip through things too quickly to slow me down, you all are a pretty savvy group, so I don't want to belabor my point. I'll just go through them, and if there's questions later, I'll try to answer those. So the State Board got involved in online charter schools because the charter school law has a provision in it that allows the State Board to waive all but a short list of the law's provisions, as you probably know. When the law was originally passed in 1999, everyone tried to think through all the possible scenarios, but just in case they had forgotten something, they included this provision in case something arose that no one had anticipated. Prior to 2007, the waivers granted by the State Board were mostly along the lines of giving preference to the children of school founders in enrollment, rather than sticking strictly to the lottery process outlawed in law. And as Dana mentioned this morning, in 2005, a new provision was added to the charter school law that required that if a charter school offered online programs, then 50% of the charter school students needed to come from the sponsoring district. The board was not asked to waive this particular provision until the fall of 2007. In 2007 and 2008, a number of schools asked for a waiver of the 50% provision. Insight School of Oregon, Oregon Virtual Academy, West Lane Technology Learning Center, two web academies, and Oregon Connections Academy. So unlike the prior waiver requests, the board recognized that these requests could affect education statewide. So they used a little different process in response to the requests. The board took a step back and asked for information about the school program and gave the schools the opportunity to make presentations to the board. It also held a hearing on the concept of online learning generally in November of 2007, and I think some of you provided feedback on that. As the board worked on this subject over the last 2 years, the issues revolving around online learning seem to fall into five categories: governance and accountability, teachers, students and equity, the education program, and funding issues. In terms of governance, a number of issues came up. I won't read all through these, but the primary issue was the perceived disconnect between a local education program potentially affecting all the schools in the state. In terms of teachers, the primary issues seemed to be whether the teacher was qualified and how much contact there was between the student and teacher. Senate Bill 767, which was reviewed earlier today, touches on some of these issues. Students in equity, a big concern for some. Some people argue that online schools better meet the needs of students who have individual academic needs, who work, who might not have access to some courses, or otherwise do not fit well within the traditional brick-and-mortar structures of a school. Others argue that online schools discriminate against those who don't speak English or don't have an adult at home during the day. Some online schools require that students pay for their internet connection. And again, Senate Bill 767 does touch on some of these issues. Education program. This is an area where I found the most research had been done, and your presenter this morning, that organization has done a lot of research on the education program. Again, Senate Bill 767 contains a list of program requirements. So it's not quite the same issue. You have a vault. Another big issue is funding and budget transparency. Do online schools cost less? Do they cost more because of the technology? There's not a lot of real good research. When I did look at this topic 2 years ago, there wasn't much research done at all, but maybe now there's been more. Certainly you can ask people who are involved in online learning what they're reimbursed in other states. There's also some question as to whether there's the same degree of transparency in terms of budgets as a brick and mortar school, so that's something to keep in mind. And also, right now, the online charter schools that are operating are using the online charter school funding formula, and you might take a look at that and ask whether that's the best formula to use. Now back to the schools that asked for the waiver of the 50-50 provision. What happened to those? So Oregon Virtual Academy and Insight School of Oregon requested a waiver at the end of 2007. A board subcommittee recommended approval of both with conditions. As a matter of process, the board denied the original request and invited the schools to resubmit the request with some of the conditions that they found would ease some of their concerns. And I'll get to those in a minute. Oregon resubmitted their request and included those conditions, and the board did approve the request in June 2008. Insight did not resubmit its request. The ORVA conditions, the sending district approved student enrollment in ORVA above the 50-50 split, that there be a limit of 600 students per ORVA. The approval assumed that all teachers would be licensed as they had testified to, and that Oregon standards be used, and that performance audits be conducted by a third party. The waiver would be good until July 1, 2010. Now, Insight did not resubmit its waiver request, and it has chosen to operate as an alternative education provider. So that means that Insight approaches each district individually and asks to contract with it as an alt-ed provider. And that sidesteps a lot of the governance issues because students remain district students. And what's required for an alt-ed placement is that the student be assessed prior to placement. And so that alleviates some concerns about whether this is an appropriate placement. Another school that asked for a request was West Lane Technology Learning Center. This school was a little different from ORVA and Insight in that it's a blended learning program. It has a bricks and mortar element in addition to the online component. Also, it was more homegrown, if you will. It was started by members of the district who wanted to serve primarily the students in its district. So it was quite a bit smaller than some of these other schools. So West Lane requested a waiver in November of 2007. The board granted the waiver in March 2008, again with conditions that the school be limited to 100 full-time students, that the school may enroll no more than 75 students who reside outside the Fern Ridge School District, that the school continue to primarily offer a blended program of both in-classroom and online programs. And that waiver was granted until July 1, 2009, which coincided with the expiration of their charter, as I understand it. Their waiver about to expire in May, just this last May in 2009, they requested a renewed waiver. The board did approve that waiver request with similar conditions as before, except the school was now limited to 120 full-time students instead of 100, and then the waiver was granted until July 1, 2011. Both Marcola and Sisters Web Academies requested waiver of the 50-50 provision in April of 2008. The school developer met with a board subcommittee the next month and immediately began offering to make changes to his proposal. So the board developer decided to withdraw his initial request, and I think the plan was to resubmit with some conditions that the board was comfortable with. But my understanding is that he never did resubmit, and that he believes he can operate his program within the 50-50 constraint. Oregon Connections Academy. The school requested the waiver last September. The board approved the request in June, again with conditions that the enrollment be capped at 2,800, that students and siblings enrolled by May 1st of 2010 could continue attending ORCA without sending district approval, but that new students enrolled after May 1st of 2010 must receive sending district permission. The waiver would expire July 1, 2011. We at the department believe that the provisions of Senate Bill 767 revoke this waiver that the board gave. So during the discussions about online learning, the board indicated that these factors were important to them, that the program have quality teachers and curriculum, that the sending district have some responsibility for their students, that parents and students would have a choice of online providers, that such schools be appropriately funded, not too much as to be wasteful, but not so little that they couldn't be successful. And finally, that the district or the state provide adequate oversight of these schools. They're a new type of school, and they probably could use some help. The board believes that full-time online learning is an option that should be part of a public education system, at least for some students. So again, over the last 2 years, the board considered different models in delivering online education. There's a school-delivered model, such as ORCA and ORVA, a single school delivering out over the state. There's a district-delivered model. Salem-Keizer Online, for example, has an online component it delivers to its students. ESD delivered, Cool School from Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD offered an online school program, or state delivered. Department of Education, as you know, has the Oregon Virtual School District, so that's one type of statewide program. I like to think of that as a library that districts can just pick and choose from. Also, as you heard described this morning, Florida operates its own statewide school. It has teachers as state employees, and it's a big deal. So, considering all those possibilities, the board approved for purposes of feedback, distributing their proposal. So that's what I believe Dana sent to you. So their proposal was that the board would require that all districts have an online option. The state would invite programs to bid to be certified by the state. Entities that wish to provide education statewide would respond to the bid. And it's thought that this upfront bidding response might help to contain costs a little bit. Staff would review the submitted programs and recommend approval or disapproval to the board, who would ultimately make the decision. Then from these certified programs, districts could then choose from among them and either take a state rate that the state might set or negotiate with the provider to maybe customize their program. Maybe the district wanted to provide a service that the online provider couldn't, you know, maybe music or sports or something. And so each contract could be a little bit different depending on how the district decided it wanted their online program to look. Parents, if they wanted to request a program that the district hadn't contracted with, could make that request of the district. But the district could turn down the request if they felt like the program wasn't as effective or maybe was cost prohibitive. Providers could be charter schools or districts or ESDs or possibly some other type of nonprofit entity, and then those entities could in turn then contract with a commercial vendor if they wanted to. Districts would approve student placement. And as for funding, the district would receive its regular state allocation for the student residing in their district, and then the district would turn around and pay the online provider either the negotiated sum or the sum that the state had negotiated. Then when the program came up for recertification, student performance data would be available, and that would be considered in terms of a decision about recertifying the program. So the board hasn't ironed out all the details, but this was sort of the general outline of the proposal. Advantages of the proposal would include creating a number of virtual charter school options for districts and students to choose from. It would provide some oversight by the state. Districts would retain primary responsibility for contracting for services. And, after they chose from the list certified by the state. The disadvantage would be that the department would need some funding for the staff. Parents might have a little less choice, and it would probably take a little time to get this up and running. So thank you for your attention. This is just recaps very at a high level the board's work. I handed out to you kind of a month-by-month inventory of what the board did over the last 2 years, just so you would have that. And I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions? I'll start off just as a clarification. Regarding Oregon Connections Academy, when the bill passed and was signed, it actually removed the waiver that they had. But under the bill, let me see if I get all the things correct. The period of time in which they don't have to comply or don't need a waiver is still July 1st, 2011. The one thing that was in the waiver that is not in the bill is effective, I believe, for enrollment beginning May 1st, 2010, where you would need the permission of the district that is sending the student. That is not in the bill, so that requirement is not there. The cap is slightly different, actually, and it's almost slightly different by accident. Some of us were surprised where the cap ended up. I think it ended up, the superintendent can tell me, it's like 2574. I think in doing that amendment, we were trying to basically make it similar to the waiver that had already been granted, but we were looking at the enrollment estimates from the Department of Ed, and those enrollment estimates ended up being a couple hundred students plus higher than what the actual enrollment was. But just because the waiver is no longer there, the Connections Academy is still can continue, and largely similar to the waiver that they had received. I just wanted to get that on the record. Yes.
I had a question.
Yes.
Is that okay? On the proposal that the board had, you went through and it talked about districts must approve placement. Is that if I'm a parent and I want to pursue an online option for my students, under this proposal, would the district be required to make sure that I had an option that I could choose, or would they be required to have some options, but on top of that, could they tell me no, that's not?
My understanding of the proposal, yes, is that all school districts would have to have an option. And if, but at the end of the day, the district would be making the final placement decision. So if the district, for example, said, you know, we've assessed your student, we don't think this is going to work for your student, they would be able to say no. But again, the board didn't spend a lot of time debating the fine points of the proposal. They wanted to approve it and get it out and hear those kinds of issues from, you know, the field to figure out how to fine-tune it.
Can I just follow up?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that would be interested to look at that, I have a background in special education, and probably one of the most contentious points of planning for special education is that point of placement. And there's the idea in special education that the parent is an equal member of the team. But at the end of the day, the district has the ultimate authority to choose what kind of education the child has, which kind of undermines that idea of the parent being a, you know, an equal participant on the team, because they can say, I want my child fully included. And at the end of the day, the district can say no, and if you disagree, you have to sue us. So I just think it would be interesting to look at how that has worked in special education in terms of conflict, access, achievement.
Absolutely, and I think that was one reason why the board decided to just make a statement and see what kind of feedback it elicited.
One thought I've had on that issue as a public school superintendent is that it does seem to me that if a school district offers an option for online education, that might be something that you take into consideration as to whether then they would have the right to deny the opportunity to go to another program. In our district, we have been working at developing that option just because of the issue of retaining students and serving our own population more effectively. And so that's a thought to consider in that decision-making process, at least from my perspective.
Well, that's a great point to clarify, because I think this proposal was really only speaking for programs that wanted to operate statewide. So if a district had an online program and it was for district students, the state wouldn't get involved in that.
Okay. Over here. Ms. McComb, Bradlin, Clackamas Webb Academy. First of all, thank you for your presentation. I had a question, and I think it's important that, first of all, we talk about the current funding structure. I know that right now charter schools are already being funded at a rate significantly lower than some of our traditional systems per pupil. And I guess in looking at your presentation where you raised the question, do online schools cost less or more, I think it's important for this committee to have a basis or an understanding how much it really costs to serve a kid in a traditional system. And then from that, I think then refer to what it looks like in an online system and then make those kinds of judgments. And so I guess my question to you is there a body of work that the Department of Ed has put out that we can look at that looks at how much it costs to serve a student in a traditional system and in a charter system?
Mm-hmm. Well, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Mr. Lynn, there is the quality education model that is out there, and that looks at bricks and mortar schools. It does not look at online schooling, but I was muttering to one person today, that would be a great request to ask of them if somebody could take a look at that and look at what is a brick and mortar school, what kind of services do they offer, for what price, and what of that list does an online school offer, and look at those cost differences. Mm-hmm. One kind of anomaly about the charter school funding formula is that there's a minimum in the state law of, you know, 80 and 95% going to the charter school. But the charter school can negotiate with the sponsoring district for a higher amount. Mm-hmm. It could negotiate for 100%. And if you all decide that you want the sending district to do something, the resident district, then they wouldn't get any of the money for the services they would provide. And so that's just kind of something that people didn't think about when they first created that charter school funding formula.
Yes, follow up.
Oh, and then I guess to follow up, I think if we were to do that type of work, I think it would be important if we could have numbers, I think, distributed by region, because I think as you look at the state of Oregon and the educational landscape in different regions, I think it costs more and or less depending on the economic viability of the community.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage of Oregon districts offer online education?
That I could not really ask Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser. I'm not sure. I'm not even sure entirely that that's data that we formally collect. We know it anecdotally from just talking to districts, but I can try to get you that.
Thank you. I think that would be important to know, and the migration rate, if it's an emerging part of the curriculum and delivery, and they're anticipating implementing it, I think that would be important to know.
Any additional questions? Yes.
Hi. The board proposal says that all districts must have an online option. So could you define what the board meant by that? When they're talking about an online, are they talking about districts needing to offer to students online courses? Or are you talking about an online school availability, online charter school availability? What does it mean when all districts must have an online option?
Well, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, and Task Force Member Reagan, I would ask that someone correct me who was there, but I think they meant a comprehensive online option, so like a school, not just supplemental.
Really?
And do you know why they came to that decision?
We have a board member here, too. Go ahead.
I didn't want to put you on the spot if you don't want
well,
to.
Well, again, yeah. Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Member Reagan. I would have to speculate a little bit, but they heard from a lot of folks about how this online learning was working for their family, and that while it wouldn't work for all students, it might be a great option to have just as an option for their students to better serve them and their needs.
Squire, would you like to?
Senator Devlin, Representative Gelser. I think there were the thinking was that if we were going to get in the business of seeking proposals and putting on a list of approved providers, organizations that provided full-time schooling, and a local district had that kind of a request that they considered to be appropriate, they should make it available, and it wouldn't be that difficult to do because we would have provided the structure. But I also think that it was the intention that there be some blended opportunities available to students. And so I didn't see it as an either. I didn't understand it as an either-or proposition. Because it is part of the board's recommendation that there be district involvement in the placement of students, our thought was that was a sensible expectation. We'll see what kind of comment we hear as the draft is. Thank you.
Additional. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For Jan or Nikki, either one, did the board use the quality education model's goals and philosophies in as kind of a backdrop for the proposal?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, not overtly, but our chair does sit on the Quality Education Commission, so those were probably in the back of his mind.
Yes.
Could I get a clarification on the state approves providers? Were you intending that there would be a minimum set of criteria that were followed, and then once those conditions are met, the state unconditionally grants an approval of this provider? Or is it on a case-by-case basis, once this is met, we will then determine whether or not a provider is allowed to operate?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, and Mr. Horning. I think the understanding was that the Department of Education, with a work group, would write administrative rules as to how this would look, and that then they would write a bid proposal and invite online providers to make a proposal to the department, and then the department staff would review the proposals as submitted according to some criteria that they would have in administrative rule. But, you know, that criteria could be different for an elementary school than a middle school than a high school.
But if it was three providers offering three elementary schools, would you then have separate negotiating blocks for the three elementary schools, or would there be a baseline level of consideration for all three elementary schools?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Member Horning, I'm not sure that we got into the details. I think they were looking at kind of a general approval, and then if the district wanted to use that provider, they would negotiate the details and any other different price.
Down here, there was another question. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Under the board guiding principles on the proposal, the second one said sending district accountability. And can you give a little bit more meat to what, how you defined it, what you were looking for on the accountability? I assume sending district is the resident district.
Sure. Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Member Vandersteck. My board members, in their discussions, were a little, not concerned exactly, but they wanted the sending district to be involved in this decision and to have a role in it. And so in all of their waiver conditions, they included sending district permission.
Okay.
So I think they were interested in that. And again, some of these kids, if this turns out not to be a good fit for them, they'll end up back with their resident school district. And so I think the board wanted to see it as sort of a team process.
It was the accountability language. That makes great sense to me. I wasn't quite sure what the accountability piece was.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ms. Squires and then Representative Gelser.
I'll just add that the idea was that there would be improved communication between the student's resident district and if a provider were not the resident district, that provider, because we did have a number of concerns brought to our attention during this 2 years about students being recruited into an online situation, dropping out of their local school district, and then the school district finding out sort of by accident that they were no longer going to that school. So we wanted to include in our proposal the presumption of good communication between the sending district and another provider.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question and an information request. I've been fascinated in this conversation and very curious about what it is that motivates students and families to choose one program over another, whether that's one commercial vendor program or a local district program. And I'm wondering if in the work that the State Board did, if you talked to parents or families or districts about what factors were considered in making the choice of where students were enrolling. And then the second part, the information request, along with Senator Morse's, if we could know the number of districts that are offering online options and within those, how their rate of the number of kids that go to pursue an outside of the district online option compared to those districts that don't have an online option. So in other words, if a district is offering one, does that reduce the number of kids that are seeking that elsewhere?
Okay. I can try to get that information for you. In terms of your original question, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, we didn't really ask the parents, why did you choose Connections Academy over Orva?
So we don't really know that. That might be a great survey question to ask the schools that are now operating, whether, you know, what factored into a parent's decision. And I think they have parent databases, too. They could maybe send out a survey.
Senator Morris?
Just to make a clarification, I would be interested in the districts that have blended programs. Mm-hmm. So not just, you know, exclusive online, but blended programs as well, because that's an indication of where the district is going. And so would add that, make sure you add that to the information. Thank you.
Additional questions? Okay. Can you provide to the committee, maybe you don't want to copy this, but can you provide them the site to the most recent version of the QEM?
Sure.
I think if people look at it, they will realize that there, and many people here have looked at it, many people are familiar with it, that it's more than just a big number, that you can actually sit and look at how you could modify the system and what the costs would be. But even within that QEM, there are complexities of, you know, not every school district is the same, not every school is the same. Even the little complexities of a school district developed with small elementary schools versus large elementary schools. Not saying which one is better, but even the cost of an administrator has a significant principal, has a significant impact on the cost per student on a small versus large. Some schools have local options, others do not. Some schools are Title I, others are not. About everybody claims the same number of kids, special education, IDEA. When you get into trying to figure out an overall number for how much per pupil, it's really kind of a disingenuous task, because the money isn't really distributed as a number per pupil. Most of the federal money, not all of it, but most of it goes towards specific for specific purposes for specific students. Now, obviously, if a charter school has a student that is in need of IDEA services, they should have the resources to provide those services to that student, meaning they should have the dollars. If a charter school happens, I don't even know what, how you determine this, if they have enough students to qualify for Title I, do they qualify for Title I dollars? But I think there are a lot of questions out there like that. And I don't think we're going to answer in the next 3 months every question that comes up. I think our job is to answer just some of the basic questions. So it's more of a statement than a question. Let me put you on the spot a little bit. If any of the members of this committee have any questions that they want to submit to the Department of Education, who should they submit them to?
Well, you're welcome to submit them to me. I meant to bring business cards. I forgot. Cindy's also here and can take those back, or you could submit them to Dana, who could forward them to either of us.
Yeah, and I can't just pass them on to the board member to my left.
There you go.
So, any additional questions? Yes.
When the Department of Education was looking at this issue, was there any discussion about how the department might support districts in tracking students who move on to virtual school? Because, I mean, the issue is that when they come, my understanding is that once they move into a virtual school, they kind of disappear at some respect. How is it that a home district can track how the student is doing, or can they?
Well, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Task Force Member Regan, I think right now the department's data collection, I don't know whether it would allow you to do that or not. When school districts put in for their funding for their ADMW, if a student is no longer in Portland Public Schools, but they've moved over to ORCA, then they show up as an ORCA student, not as a Portland Public Schools student. Mm-hmm. So whether there's some way we can tweak the data collection processing system, we might be able to do that. I know we hesitate to gather yet another piece of data from school districts because it becomes so burdensome, but if that's something that, you know, this task force is interested in doing, we can go back and ask if that can be done.
Anything more from this side?
It's a long march.
Representative Denver. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up on that point. So if, you know, under the charter law, the student leaving their district, and I guess there's also the question of, I mean, many students are entering the virtual school directly from home, right? That is, they were never part of the school district. But the school district would be getting some percentage of their ADMW in either case, is that not right? So then there would have to be some tracking involved, wouldn't there?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Task Force, or Representative Denbrough, I think we heard testimony that some districts found out they had a student when they got some money for the student. You know, part of that, they split up the difference between the 20 or the 95, and so they received some funding from maybe ORCA, and they thought, little Mikey Denbrough is going to ORCA now. I didn't know we even had a little Mikey Denbrough. The question highlights how complex this student gets. You can't just be an expert in one area. You have to know how the school funding formula works. You have to know what kind of data we collect. You quickly get into all of this detail, of which I am sorry to say, not really equipped to answer.
Mm-hmm. And can I just follow up?
Yeah.
Thanks, Ms. Chair. And, you know, just bringing up the subject of students who enter the system through homeschooling, you know, that, I think, to a lot of people's thinking, is an advantage of the virtual charter schools, is that it brings people into public education. And for some school districts, it can actually be a boon, right? Because they weren't getting any ADMW. Now they might be getting a little bit, right? But they would probably rather have those students in their district. So, again, just reinforcing the notion of the complexity of that, but I think all of these things will need to be looked at as we're looking at the funding implications for all of this.
Superintendent Plains.
Just adding to the complexity of that, we have a school district in our area that is a charter district, and they've elected to take the minimum to make it a maximum, so they get 100% of the money. The sponsoring district gets the entire amount. So with that said, we have kids going there that we don't know about, unless they're special ed. If they're special ed, of course, we do. But otherwise, there's really no tracking system for that.
Yes.
Would you like me to answer a bunch of those if you'd like?
I realized that as those questions were being asked. So would you
like me to take a shot at it?
Yes.
Okay. So several things. First, you should always be able to look at the SSID system to see where a student's going. And at a district level, you can look that up. And although not every district updates that as frequently as ODE would like, that's coming as part of the paperwork reduction task force work that they did, so that's coming. In our case, we send out a list to every district of the students that are in ORCA monthly, whether they were homeschooled or not homeschooled. So they would have notice of that, and they would have addresses and contact information should they want to contact Johnny to say, hey, we have something over here that we'd like you to look at to see if we can meet your needs. So, and then finally the checks go out, which does trigger some districts that they have students involved, and then the records request when the student signs up goes to the district. So those are the things we, and I don't know that every district, every school does it the same, but those are the kind of things we do. So
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Gary, this, and maybe Larry, at school district level, is there
any type of an exit paper that a parent fills out when they're taking their student out of, say, traditional brick and mortar to do something else. They're moving out of the district, they're transferring them to Orca, they're going to homeschool them. Is there any sheet that's filled out to ask the parent why they're moving Johnny or Mikey out of the school? Little Jennifer was being bullied and couldn't get the district to do anything, so we're pulling Jennifer out. Do we have any data?
One of the things that ORCA does when any student disenrolls is the principal calls them to find out why. So that happens in the charter school situation. In my regular brick and mortar schools, I would expect that the principals would know why they're leaving. But if we get an inter-district transfer on a student, I make my administrators call the parents to let them know that we're ready to have them back anytime they want and find out what's going on. But there's no survey that they do to find out, you know, why you left, were you dissatisfied with the district, any of that.
And
yes.
I would add, too, that there's a difference between charter schools and how well they respond. Gary's right. ORCA is very good about letting us know that they have our kids enrolled. We have 24, I think, students enrolled in ORCA from my school district. We know who they are and we know they're there. We have 22, I think, in Ed Choices. We don't know. And we try to spend time tracking those kids, but looking up kids on SSID takes staff time. That's money. That could be going other places. The other piece of that is they don't update the database as well. And so you can have people tracking the SSID, but the names may not be there yet. And so, again, the accountability of the system has lots of holes in it. And some of the online programs are very good about it, and some aren't.
Dana.
I was just going to mention your packets at the dais. There's a last clipped package that is information from ORCA and ORVA about where their students come from and to the extent that they know where their students go if they disenroll. I just want to let you know that information was in there.
Yeah. Any additional questions at this time? Seeing none, thank you very much. Senator Morris.
If I might, are we pressed for time? If you are,
Really. I think we're going to finish at 3:30, and I think we can make that.
Okay. Well, my question may blow up. Okay. So, gavel me down. Jan, if you would maybe talk about the board's deliberation on requirement for districts to approve placement in contrast to, you know, the family choice. And what we heard in our committee, and I heard individually from more than a number of parents, is that the district looks first at the dollar and then at the need of the student. Now, that's coming from the families. And this is an issue that is very difficult, I think it would seem to me, for administrators to put on a totally objective hat when knowing that if the student leaves and they have the right to deny it, that they're making the decision in the best interest of the student, not in the best interest of where the funds go. Was that deliberated within the board and kind of, where did that go?
Well, Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Senator Morris, there was some deliberation. Again, I'm kind of looking at Director Squire out of the corner of my eye. I think, you know, that is really a judgment call that you all will probably ultimately make. I think you can find parents who have had a bad experience with their district and feel like their district didn't meet their needs. I think if you talk to a district employee, they'll say, you know, we put students first, and we might know more about what a particular child needs in terms of, you know, an IEP or an individual, you know, plan and profile than maybe the parent knows. There's certainly a tension there. And I think that the board wanted to see teamwork
from everyone involved and to really work towards that. Among the reasons why a district could disapprove a request by a parent, let's say the district went with ORCA but they didn't go with ORVA, and the parent wants to enroll their student in ORVA. The board said maybe the district has a legitimate educational reason for making that denial, or maybe they don't feel like the other program is as effective, or maybe they come in much higher at a much higher cost and the district can't afford it. So the board was trying to weigh these things, and they came down, for at least purposes of getting feedback, that the district would make the decision. I don't know that they're wedded to that. I think they would be open to having that discussion.
Okay. Senator Morse, have you concluded?
Thank you. Yeah. I suspect.
Ms. Hunt?
I have a few added comments. Also, I think, you know, when the State Board granted ORVA the waiver specifically with the conditions that the sending district approval, they did that for a period of 2 years to be able to gather some information about how that would be working. ORVA is now going into its second year, so it's had a year of operation. And I know that when ORVA first, so to speak, opened its doors, we got a lot of questions from districts. What is this program? What's this ORVA? Never heard of it. Well, you know, you can go here on their website, check them out. And I believe most districts are approving all students that ask to go to ORVA. There are a few districts that are saying no to everyone, and there's a few, I believe, that are in the middle that are looking at individual students. So it's kind of across the board. But in speaking to the ORVA representatives upstairs, I know that they've seen growth from, in their first year, I think they had about 250, and now this year they have 500 and some. So the districts are approving the students to go. And, you know, and so I know part of the board's expectation was to kind of look at that and just see what do the districts do with this kind of authority. You know, do they revoke? Do they give it for a year? What kind of conditions are they imposing? So the data that's kind of being collected off of ORVA, I mean, but for this task force and all of 767, was meant to sort of inform, I think, the board's future decisions in this area as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Lynn.
I had a question. Looking at board proposals on, and I think it was the last slide of your presentation, at what point then, if the district option, looking at district approval, if it's a failing school that they're approving, does that voice then be taken away and then in the hands of the parent to choose a school that's maybe academically performing better?
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Gelser, Task Force Member Lynn, that's a great nuance to this. I don't think, again, we've got into that detail, but if you were to write a law, you might want to incorporate what kind of criteria and elaborate more. When can a district say no?
Okay, that concludes this point. Thank you very much for coming. We will probably have you back sometime in the future. Now we're going to move backwards in our agenda, and we're going to briefly go an overview of the task force work plan. I'll give Dana a couple of seconds here to...
Well, let's give everyone a couple of seconds. It's the third page of the packets here at the dais, and these dates should all seem familiar, but possibly one, which is, I'll just run through, and we've got today, obviously, our next meeting, September 30th in the afternoon. I just generally block out 1 to 5. It means it'll be sometime within those hours. If we all need all 4 hours, we'll use them. But October 19th, we're planning on a morning meeting. And then there's an addition of the fifth date, November 2nd, that the chairs are tentatively looking at to get the task force work done. So just flag that one, and we'll start to... Cindy's looking at me strangely. Third page of the... Did you not get one? I'm sorry. And then
it's right after
hopefully
the, right after the
our last meeting date. I'm sorry, it's the fourth page. Hopefully our last meeting date would be November 17th in order to line ourselves up to report to those education committees on November 19th.
One of the things that's identified here on September 30th is Co-Chair Gelser and I will probably be in contact with with each of you over the next month. Looking at the scope of work that this task force has to do, to just simply address the issues that are before it, not that we have to come to a conclusion on every issue, and we may choose not to conclude and not to go forward in that area, it is very difficult for a group of 17 to do that. So we're going to probably break up the group into different subgroups working on issues to report back. And when you get to the portion of the agenda today where it asks you the four questions, that fourth question is one of the most crucial questions. That is, how much time do you have over the next 3 months to devote to this? Because I think for us to get the kind of product we are envisioning and to get broad acceptance of that product from all the stakeholders, it is going to take a considerable commitment of time and resources. So, okay. Well, now we will go to the last item on our agenda, which is sort of an organized task force discussion. Each of you received four questions. You do not have to give a 10-minute soliloquy on the four questions, but we thought we would go around the group just so that we get a little bit more feel for what people are thinking, what issues they think are important, how they would like this process to proceed, so we can just get some feel for individual members. And so I think this morning we started over on that side, didn't we? So, Ms. Hunt, okay. You're it.
I'm it. I even have my four questions here. I think as far as what issues are most important for the task force to address, we heard a lot of that this morning and this afternoon, is from the department's perspective, we'd like to see high-quality programs. We heard, I think, a lot of that discussion this morning and this afternoon with appropriate accountability measures. We're also very concerned with equity and, you know, that all students have equitable access to these programs, whether they be students who are receiving special education services, students from low-income families, all of those kinds of issues. And there's been certain concerns that have been raised over the last 2 years around that in different regards. So that's, I think, a big issue for us. As far as the second question, as far as the report and recommendations, I think looking down the recommendations, some of those have been addressed by 767. For example, teacher licensure, 767 answered that 100%. I don't know if we're looking to change that or not, but I think I'm going to jump ahead to the biggest challenge, is that the biggest challenge to me is time for the task force. We have 3 months, 2 months. This is a huge issue. I think you've heard already today that it touches every single subject area in education. It touches on different service delivery models. So one of the, I don't know, almost initial decisions to make is, are we only going to address charter schools, or is it bigger? And what I'm hearing today is it's bigger. And so we have a significant challenge with time and narrowing our scope or not, as the case might be. But, and I say that I'm kind of, but it's, so time is, I think, the biggest challenge. And then as far as how much time, well, I'm right across the street. No, the department is, I know we're very committed to this. On a personal level, I have furlough days to contend with. And I have a couple of those in the next couple of months that affect the whole week that a furlough day is in. But, and so I think I'll end it with that.
I would agree with task force member Cindy Hunt in the sense that I, too, am committed to the work. It's important for us and myself as a charter school principal that if this is our focus, that we get it right. I think a lot of the charter schools that I'm associated with and the building principals that are running those schools would agree with some of the language that is there in Senate Bill 767. I think there are some nuances, though, that we need to iron out. And I think I'm committed in working with this committee and making sure that we do get that right. you know, we're also committed in preserving parental choice in this matter. I think at the end of the day, yes, there are some accountability systems in place that I think academically and fiscally hold schools in check, and I think they're good. I just think that we just need to figure out how online schools fit in that matter, and some of those nuances are spelled out in Senate Bill 67, and further discussion, I think, will bring it forward. I also think that in the effort of time, you know, 3 months is short, but and again, to make sure that we do this right, if we stay committed to the charge and there are dates on the calendar, that I will make time in my schedule to provide and be intended in the meeting.
Senator Bonamici.
My turn. Thank you. The issues to address, I think we've learned this morning, and those of us who participated in the hearings and in Senate Bill 767 know the tremendous scope of issues. I think it was sort of emphasized today in trying to compartmentalize all the different types of online learning that we talked about, the full-time, the supplemental, blended, just the use of technology in classrooms. So I think that the role of online learning is something that we need to discuss. The three issues that I'm primarily concerned about with the overall goal of doing what's best for all the students in Oregon is the funding issue, the accountability issue, and the equity issue, all have been mentioned previously. The next question was, what should we hope to achieve as a task force? I think we need clarity. Obviously, we need to support online learning. I don't think there's any question about that. It's pretty clear that there's lots of benefits to online learning, but with the accountability and equity, I think, are important pieces. Challenges, of course, there's the how much can we do in a short period of time issue, but there's also a challenge that I've noticed both in the building and some of the outside reading that I've done about this issue, and that's that there tends to be a preconceived notion when discussing this issue that certain groups are opposed to innovation or care only for protecting the status quo or protecting teachers and not caring about students. But I think in reality, there's really just honest differences about what's best for students. And I think that trying to come to some sort of consensus on that issue is going to be very important. Strategy to deal with that is that I certainly intend to keep an open mind and hope everyone else does as well. Time commitment, how much time in committee and outside of committee am I willing to devote to this work? I have, some of you might have heard me say that I just got back last night from dropping off my youngest child at college, so I have an empty nest and not another job, so I have lots of time. I do have some conflicts already with some of the existing dates for the task force that I'll need to work around. So it's more juggling, but I do have quite a bit of time to commit.
It's difficult to follow. As far as the issues most important, I think you're going to hear the same thing. The issue of equity and providing access and equity for every student, it's going to be a huge challenge, I believe. Also, the idea of holding virtual schools to the same high standards of accountability and access that we hold all other public schools, and the financial structure, that this is about how Oregon's tax dollars are spent, and being cognizant of that we don't cannibalize a system as we're trying to make sure that we're offering options to every student. I think it's going to be a huge challenge in the discussion, especially in the current economic times. I think it's possible to make huge progress, but I do think we might want to consider looking at short-term achievable goals and long-range goals as a way to divvy up the work groups even. Which parts of 767 need immediate addressing, and which can we
do we need more research, more data, more information in order to make sensible conclusions around? And so is there a way to do short-term, long-term? And I don't have the answer on that. I think the challenge of time always exists. I have all of the committee meetings on my calendar. I also serve on the Department of Ed's design team for the Race to the Top Fund, so I have several of the other dates. So I will give every amount of bit of time I possibly can, but that concerns me as far as beyond the current committee meetings, where I'll juggle all of that, but I'm sure I'll find a way. And I'm committed to working with everybody and agree with the senator, an open mind, that we not assume that we know what certain entities think or believe would be really helpful in the process.
So I'll kind of mix this up a bit. I think my biggest challenge is I have to continually remind myself that the education that I got as a kid is not the education that my children are getting. And it's hard for me not to want the same thing for them that I had. But they really are getting so much more. And so, you know, I just have to always keep thinking about evolving and our school system evolving and that kind of stuff. But as far as the important things for me are, you know, I think we came into this probably a little late as far as catching up with rules. And so wouldn't it have been nice to be 10 years ago and be doing this now? And then when everyone came to the table, they'd come with the same standard set of rules to play by. I think one of the things that I bring is the opportunity to try to figure out, you know, the nuances between all these and unintended consequences and that kind of stuff. But it's important to me that we only have quality providers in the state. And I think we've been very lucky so far. And I agree with the speaker this morning. It only takes one bad school to give us all a black eye. And that's true in regular education as well. And so that's important. But also, whatever we're paying for the education of the child, whether it be in bricks and mortar or in an online school, I want to make sure that they're getting that value. So if we're paying $5,000 for that student to get an education, I want them to get $5,000 worth of an education. That's pretty important to me. But I hope at the end of this, we kind of have some standardized things so that we're all working under the same set of principles, because right now we kind of have a mixture. So, and I'm only 30 minutes away, so I am committed to be here whenever you need me, and know that there is no question that's off limits as far as what we do. So,
Senator Morris. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having served on the Education Committee this last session, I came away with some observations and concerns, and I would express them as issues for us to deal with. And it appeared, and I hope that I'm incorrect, but it appeared that there was a degree of institutional resistance to change and the application of technology to further education and improve the quality. And that institutional resistance, I sensed it. And I think we're at a crossroads, and I think this task force represents a wonderful opportunity to kind of reset. And rather than looking at institutional resistance, looking at embracing technology and how does it enhance and improve the educational opportunity for all students in the state. And I have concerns about rural districts that don't offer the same things that Mr. Chair, your district school offers.
I have five.
You have the gold standard. And technology represents that opportunity to provide equity and access to curriculum that may not otherwise exist. How that then relates to charter schools and the complete dedication to online it is one that we need to figure out. The most important issue is governance and accountability and performance, and set those standards and provide a way to integrate between the policy that the legislature sets and the governance within the Board of Education. to make sure that this whole system is rationalized. The other issue that I think is of great importance, and I hear it frequently, is the conflict between what families want for their children and what schools believe is in the best interest for their children, and how to rationalize that difference in a way that really treats the student as the customer, not the institution. And so those are issues that I think that we can tackle, and hopefully we'll come up with excellent proposals. With respect to the time issue, I do have a very deep interest in this. I do have conflicts in the two later November dates, the 17th and the 19th. But other than that, I'm here to do the work.
I think from a school board perspective, I hope I'm representing my colleagues in saying that I think in general online presents some incredible opportunities for us as we go forward. And it's not a question of if online will be coming. It's a question of how and how soon. And I think it's really important for us here to get it right to the extent we can. And to embrace it and to always be keeping the needs of students in the forefront. So in terms of the issues that are most important, I think probably the most important thing is for us to try to kind of sort out the balance between making online courses available to district versus making online schools available. And I think there is a sweet spot. I don't know what it is, but I think it feels to me like we're behind in terms of the online course availability to districts large and small, and the huge impact, positive impact that could have. In terms of a couple of issues, smaller issues to look at, I would love for us to look at the idea of online education for kids younger than 11 or 12 and what's appropriate or not. Higher levels of financial accountability, we need to really understand what it costs for online education versus bricks and mortar education and potentially recommend some adjustments. The whole issue of tracking the students from a home district perspective I think is important, especially if we want to have any accountability from the home district point of view. The whole role of the home district in determining the best online offering. Do we need to dig deeper a little bit when it comes to ELL children or special needs children or high poverty children? Would there at some point be different ways the districts would look at what makes sense for children? I don't know. But I do think that the districts and teachers would have a good sense of what might make sense for a child, depending on who they are. Equitable access is huge. Whether online can meet better or worse the needs of special needs kids, TAG students, ESL, all of those are things. One of the things that I certainly want to be trying to represent at some level from a school board perspective is the whole notion of the survivability of small districts in Oregon. And there's a difference there if you're offering accessibility to online courses versus accessibility to online schools where the whole ADM goes away, because it's a bigger issue for very, very remote and small school districts, because if you lose too many children, you could lose your whole community. So, I do think we have to figure out that piece of it. In terms of challenges, I think I would agree with Gary and Senator Morse. The biggest challenge is that this is new, it's different. We as adults in the room don't necessarily have the experience of online learning ourselves. It's already kind of out of the gate. We're to some extent playing catch up, so I think that's one of our challenges. In terms of time, I'm happy to try to devote as much time as I possibly can to this issue. I want to make sure that we get it right. And again, I think the biggest thing for us to do is to try to keep student needs front and center. And if we do that, we'll come up with good decisions.
Go to the far end down here.
Oh, okay.
Well, I said I thought our needs were a little unique in LeGrand and Eastern Oregon. And just to paint you a little picture to give you an idea of what's happening with charter schools, where I'm from in Union County, it feels a little bit like the Wild West out there. 50% of the school districts in Union County are charter districts. They're charter school districts. What's happened is that because of a lack of students in the schools and the inability to run the schools on the economics that we have, districts have gotten to the point to where they're going to be a charter school to get around the residency law so that inter-district transfers aren't required. In my world, what's happened is in one of the districts, we have 75 kids going out to that district, and we're not a large district. We're around 2,200 kids. 25 now going to Cove, which was has just become a charter district. And so there's 100 students right there. About 40, between 40 and 45 of our kids are online charter kids. And so we're taking a huge hit in Eastern Oregon where we are. One of the districts that's become a charter district is now running a bus into our school district to pick up kids. And you can imagine how that rubs people the wrong way in a small community. And so it's creating frictions, I think is an understatement with what's happened with charter schools. I don't think, obviously, that was ever an intent, but it's happening. It's real. And so we're dealing with those things the best we can. For us, I think we have concerns, and I met with my administrative team that has studied this quite a bit. One of our big concerns as far as tracking the online charter districts is the requirement for enrollment reporting. There isn't any as far as back to the resident school, so you can't track where your kids are. Now, some, like I said earlier, some districts do a great job with that, and other folks aren't. And so that's a real small thing that could be improved. The other area where we're really concerned, because with us, with sending so many kids, for example, we have 15 kids attending Imbler Charter School District. Our special ed director is on the road all the time going out there for IEP meetings because we're responsible for that IEP. And the big part of that, of course, is then the funding and the development of a contract around that funding. And so we've got some issues there that right now we're spending money on lawyers to try to work that out so that we can have some kind of an agreement as to what's going to be paid. But special education, at one point, Senate Bill 71 was passed out of the Senate, and then it died in House Committee, and that was a Senate bill that did give special education responsibility to the sponsoring school district. For us, that's really a big issue, because special education is such a big part of the whole charter school piece of things, and we'd like to see that as an area of focus. How does that play into all of this? You know, should it be the sponsoring district? Should they be responsible for the IEPs of these kids? And how do you handle those issues? Because the special ed piece of the charter school is very complicating for the resident district as far as expenses and keeping track of what's really happening. The other part of that that's big for school districts now in terms of No Child Left Behind and accountability is all of our special ed students going to charter online districts as well as charter school districts that surround us, is that we're still responsible for the AYP. So those scores come back to us, and we have no control over how those kids do. You would say, well, you're responsible for their IEP, but the truth is they're attending school in another district. We attend the meetings, but we really don't control that. Yet the scores are reflected on our report card. And that's true all over the state. So that's something to also keep in mind, that's playing out now in the state as we look at this. So those are some issues that we've talked about. Obviously, the funding issue, I think, is huge. I think we need to take a look at tracking costs for programs, maybe looking at what have been the audited costs for the online programs, including third-party programs that I think are making a pretty good profit out of this business, and looking at what the true costs are compared to brick and mortar, and come up with an equitable cost figure for what we're going to pay out for charter education. We're also kind of concerned about the 50% rule, because we do think there's a lot of latitude in that rule in terms of how home districts may be utilizing that to increase the 50% residency number. I've had some folks looking at that in terms of how that's working in different school districts, and it could be that folks are using it in a way where students are taking an online class, a resident student, and then suddenly they're counted as part of the 50%. I think that's something that we need to take a close look at in terms of how all the intricacies of the 50% rule play out, and study that closely. So those were things that we were all concerned about. But I think it does boil down to one thing: governance. How well do we govern charter school and online charter education in our state? And I think Gary kind of alluded to the fact that it's better to be late than never. We may be a little late in the day for it, but it's important to do it, and now's the time. So I will be here, I think, the best I can. I drive quite a ways. It's about a six-hour drive, depending on how fast you go. So I plan on being here as much as I can.
Let's see. Most of what we had discussed before has fallen through my notes as well. Equitable access, that the programs are high quality. I'd like to counter maybe Ms. Vandersteck's position just with our school's experience. We're heavily regulated and burdened and audited, and I don't think that's a bad thing. What I would like to see perhaps is that is expanded as well. Our accounting, our governance, everything like that is open, and maybe some of the other players in the state don't fall into that same requirement, but a level playing field for the schools at an appropriate level. Performance, to get back to what Senator Morse was saying, that we're actually held accountable for what sort of student performance is brought up, but that it's not an undue gauge on the virtual schools versus what's at the brick and mortars, that everyone is pretty much on that same basis. Are what we're hoping to achieve, that when a parent asks for alternative educational options, that there's actually some recourse for them. At the moment, if a district denies them, there's really no alternative or appeal process except to go through one of the other programs that doesn't fall under any of the district approval guidelines. And instead of them saying, well, maybe the district knows best and thank God they're looking out for the best interest of my students, what usually happens is they go to a different program, and the program they go to is great. You know, we have no problems with the quality of that program, so that's fine and good. But again, a level playing field for all the schools and districts in the state. Teacher licensure for all these programs. And the biggest challenge coming out, it is such a broad subject that this panel seems to have been tasked with. How do you cover it all in just a few short meetings without just being an inch deep? And as far as my schedule goes, this isn't my day job, so I'm taking vacation days to be here. So the more we can get done during a day, full-day meetings instead of half-day meetings, things like that would help make sure that I actually am able to attend and get something accomplished when I attend.
Thank you. Well, we're getting to that point where I have to echo the comment that the main points have already been made. I think that I will just echo some of the points that have been made. As I was reading through some of the material preparing for this meeting, one of the points that really struck me was, and I think it was in the report that Susan Patrick's organization put out, was that the states that have been most successfully moving to an integrative model of online education have been those that really sat down and did planning and met together and did that kind of advanced work that I think Gary mentioned he wishes had happened 10 years ago. And you know, for me personally, that has been a major goal for my participation in this process, was to see that kind of thing happen. Now, the challenge there, of course, is the one that's been alluded to, and that's that we only have a few months, and we can't do that kind of comprehensive work in just a few months. So I think it's really going to be critical that we do the kind of triage that Courtney kind of alluded to. What do we need to do? I mean, obviously, we have to move through the key issues that are in the charge of 767. We need to address those. But what needs to be tackled in this recommendation that comes out of this three-month process? And then what can we set the stage for in terms of further conversation about some of the long-term visioning, especially, I think, revolving around blended instruction and how that gets funded. I mean, I don't believe that we'll be able to come up with that in a few months. But we do obviously need to deal with the question of, as Frank said, governance, accountability, funding for those schools that are offering online education entirely. I think that, so aside from the time constraints, that the biggest challenge that I feared coming into this, although I'm not seeing it today, is kind of residue over all the brouhaha around Senate Bill 767. And, you know, a lot of kind of use of simplistic, reductive dichotomies. You know, you either support online education or you are a Luddite. That's just really broad terms being thrown around. And I think I really value what I'm seeing in this group to look at things more precisely. So what we really mean by online education and how things may be different depending on the age of the child, depending on just a whole variety of factors. So the more that we can keep things, full as opposed to reductive, I think the better we'll be. And, you know, towards that end, this is a major priority for me, and I will be committing a lot of time to it. So, and I look forward to that.
I think it's going to be critical that we stay focused on the mission, and there's plenty of work outlined here without getting into other weeds and perceptions and avenues that we don't have time to go down. Because of the time factor, and we all acknowledge that 2.5 months or so is not a lot of time to meet the charge that we've been given, I think it's important, since we didn't get started 10 years ago, but maybe some other states did get started 4, 5, 10 years ago, I think it's going to be important that we look to their successes and models to glean from, because maybe they had more time to meet than we do. Let's look and see what's working in Idaho, Washington, Florida, other states. And it's going to be critical for us to stay focused on our mission. Keep kids first, focused on the needs of kids. It's going to be a passion of mine to make sure that the rural needs are met, like Bobby had mentioned, remote necessaries with declining enrollment. You know, they're at risk now. What can we do to help them out? So that's going to be very important to me. Because of rural issues, Senator Bonamici, I may be reading a little too much into the equity or the access portion of it. I don't believe that we're going to come up with an approach that 100% of Oregon students are going to have access to every program. I don't think it's going to happen. We don't have high-speed internet in every corner of this state. But we just need to come up with a balanced, moderate approach that does the best for the most. And time commitment, I'm here for you.
Yes. Well, for those that know me, they're probably amazed I've been this quiet this long, so because I'm pretty passionate about this stuff. As far as a task force, I think we must, and I underline must, provide clarity around online education in the state of Oregon. People are looking to this group to do that. We don't need 197 online schools, which is where the hell we're headed right now, excuse my French. But I also believe at the same time, if I was standing in front of the state board, I would tell them that they ought to change graduation requirements, and every kid that graduates from public high school in the state of Oregon ought to at least pass successfully one online class, if not more. So my bent is to open the floodgates, but we have to have some quality control about what we're offering to our kids. It's very important. I really believe we've got the underlying thing here is we've got a couple big underlying issues that are going to rear their head and are going to make it impossible to address online learning if we don't address them at the same time. And one is some of the charter school issues. They're already filtering around whether it's an online charter or a charter school district. Believe it or not, somewhere we need to say something to it and make some suggestions. The other issue is, you know, we have to address accountability and equity, as was said by many of you. There is at least 524 schools in this state that don't have adequate connectivity. And if we're going to talk about all this online access and all these great courses and services, a lot of our kids aren't going to be able to utilize it. So at the same time, if we're speaking to the legislature, we better speak with a voice about how are we going to do that, whether it's wireless. You know, it's not cost-effective to run fiber and coax, but it is potentially wirelessly with the new technologies that are out there, and I can speak to that a little bit. But I think that's important. I think if I was dreaming, we would be coming up with some legislative package, it may be impossible in 2.5-3 months, that would set the playing field for the next 25 years in the state of Oregon about virtual education, charters, connectivity, and professional development around all of that. I think that's really important. I hope we don't get caught up in protecting turfs or old paradigms, because the truth of the matter is 25 years from now, the educational playing field in the world is going to be so much different. It already is dramatically different, and so we got to move ahead, and you know, I'm willing to jump in and do whatever's needed to get something put together between now and the middle of November, because this is pretty important for all the kids in the state of Oregon, and so whatever it is, let's get it done, and let's figure out how we're going to do it.
Mrs. Meyer.
Most of the important issues that I wrote down have been mentioned: program and staff quality, governance issues, funding, budget transparency, equity, accountability, academic attendance, retention and graduation. And then I think a couple of things that haven't been spoken to as much. There do remain some issues around public choice that will no doubt arise as we have our conversations about this. And I think that that Dennis is right in saying that we need to separate some of the issues around online learning from those that have to do with our charter school law. The two have become entangled just kind of by accident. And I know with the state board, what we found as we began to try to do that was that there isn't anybody in our group or that came before us who doesn't think that online learning is important, that every student in Oregon needs to have access to it to the degree that it's appropriate for their learning. What was more confounding were the issues that had arisen because our charter school law that was designed for one thing had come to be the vehicle for something else. I would hope, and I'm quite optimistic about this group's ability to do some very good things despite the short timeline. I hope that what we will do is take a step back from the smaller issues and focus on the big policy issues and come up with a clear plan for future direction. And maybe we can help ourselves by sorting out what we need to do from what we might task other groups to do after that is taken care of. I see our biggest challenge as finding our way to a wise policy that can stand the test of time in the midst of what is very rapid change. an environment in where there is, in which there is a lot of advocacy for particular points of view, a good deal of fiscal restraint, and complexity. I will give whatever time the task requires, with the caveat, as Representative Gelser knows and Dana knows, that I'm going to be out of the country for 3 weeks in September, virtually the whole time between now and our next meeting. But beyond that, whatever task force assignments you want to give me, I'll make myself available for.
We have one member online.
Kathleen Scalise, are you still there?
Yeah, I am here.
Thanks for hanging with us.
Are we all done with the everybody
almost
in the room there?
Just
almost
about.
Yes, okay. Well, yeah, so it's been interesting listening to you guys. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, I'm just brand new to this task force, just appointed yesterday, so I'm trying to catch up with all of you guys. But, you know, from the point of view of the University of Oregon and sort of the research agenda and so forth, where we've been looking into a lot of these ideas, you know, there's some, a lot of things you've raised here that are coming up over and over again in a lot of settings. State, national, you know, international, and so forth. A couple things I just encourage you to think about. One thing that came up again and again was scope, the scope of, you know, the tasking here. And just to reframe that a little bit, if we were talking about Oregon having appointed a face-to-face school policy task force, what would that mean? I mean, that would be like everything we do in schools, right? Everything that's going on in schools. And for somebody to say that they're doing that, they're going to do it in 2.5 months, you'd all think that's, you wouldn't even, you wouldn't even take that seriously, right?
You wouldn't take the assignment.
So in that way, it's, you know, an online task force at this point in this era of educational, you know, progress is not a little add-on, a little slice. It is a big creature similar to talking about what's our face-to-face policy, which is all of our policy today, right? So just keep in mind, this is a huge scope, and whatever can be done in 2.5-3 months is great. It's going to need to be an ongoing thing, and it's major. Another thing that came up this morning a bit around the discussion of teaching and learning was this idea that, for instance, just to quote, it doesn't make sense for everyone to recreate the best online course. Those kind of comments you're going to be really careful about, because we're still very early stages of instructional technology at any grade level, and we're kind of in the Model T era, really. So you can say, oh yeah, there are all these different models and calculus courses and so forth out there, but we haven't scratched, you know, the surface of the potential of this, and so you shouldn't be thinking of it as, oh, this is no time now to recreate more things, because we're really very much at the beginning. We're maybe 20 years into real use of instructional technology and centuries into face-to-face educational technology, so you got to think of it again as, you know, a hundredth of 1% of our educational history has had anything to do with technology, so very early days. And then I guess the last thing I would say, just about sort of the technology research that was described this morning, sort of generally, there's a lot to say, a lot to add to, and to clarify around a whole bunch of things that were brought up this morning that, you know, I'd like to say more to at some point. But some of the things have to do with what's in the research space around what's happening with technology, where the learning gains are really being achieved, the extent to which they're being achieved. And while I would agree that generally across the research space, the conclusion is either no gain from technology, in other words, it's equivalent to face-to-face, or some gain, keep in mind the Hawthorne effect in education, which shows that pretty much any research you do in any setting, including if you just go in and change the light bulb for the same light bulb, you will have a learning gain. Because interventions with teachers and students and the fact that they have more attention on them for all kinds of good and other reasons tend to lead to learning gains. So the actual meta-analysis around technology, the effect size, the amount of learning gain that you were seeing out of all the different technologies, I mean, we can talk about this and that and so forth, but they're relatively small, and the quality of the research is really quite weak, but they are triangulating toward it being, you know, either equivalent or slightly a good thing. But keep in mind about a good thing that the learning gains don't nearly reach something like reducing class size to 20 students per teacher, much larger learning gains. Good practices of formative assessment, much larger learning gains. So just to keep it in context of the whole world of possible, you know, educational teaching and learning situations that we're in, and also early days, and also definitely be thinking hybrid. The research base is showing hybrid is the place where the big impact is coming. So that's the successful blend of face-to-face with technology and online and so forth. And one last thing, you know, I just said the last thing was last, but is to do with, you know, teacher work is not my field, but I believe we do not even have endorsements in technology for teachers in the state of Oregon, as many other states do. And we don't have standards for teachers in technology. We just passed the standards for students. So there's some work to do there just in terms of these kind of basic things to keep in mind. That's kind of it.
And we have one member that has given written responses.
Yeah. Krista was with us on the phone this morning, but couldn't be here this afternoon, so she sent in her responses. With regard to what issues are most important, she said whether students need permission from their resident districts to attend an online virtual school. This includes sorting out their charter school law from the decisions made about online schools. Funding, does it really cost the online virtual school the same per student amount as a brick-and-mortar school? They don't have expenses such as transportation, food services, custodial, etc. Third, whether the resident district gets an opportunity to offer the virtual experience first before the student and family choose another online option. And do ESDs have a role to play, and if so, what is the role? With regard to what she might hope to see out of our recommendations, a clear set of written guidelines that answer the questions listed above and other questions outlined in the ODE briefing, such as the governance and the determination of the quality of such schools. The biggest challenge, she thought there were two. She said, I think our two biggest challenges will be to deliver a clear set of guidelines that include the existing online schools that likely won't meet the criteria established initially and make recommendations about how the funding should occur for online students. And with regard to availability, she said, I will make myself available for meetings as scheduled if at all possible, although as usual, I seem to be overcommitted.
Representative Gallagher, did you want to?
Yes. First of all, I just wanted to thank all of you for your willingness to commit your time to what is a very difficult task over the next several months, and I anticipate our conversations will continue to be rigorous and sometimes probably heated. I think that someone, I forget who said it earlier, this touches on all aspects of education, and I think there are few areas that are more controversial or that we feel more personally and more passionately than education, because it's something we've all experienced and it's something that we all have personal hopes around, whether it's for our children or our siblings, nieces, nephews, grandchildren. So I hope that one of my hopes is that we can respect that in one another and recognize that we probably are going to have some pretty passionate disagreement in some areas. That said, I think that there is a real opportunity for us to find some common ground around some basic issues that will set Oregon up to be able to have constructive conversations around this and hopefully allow Oregon to become a leader in the nation around how to use online learning as a tool to support our students. And I think that goes to that first question of what are the most important issues for the task force to address. I really think those basic governance issues are absolutely critical. I think it is frustrating for those who are operating these school districts to look at their competitors who may be operating under different standards and different rules. I think that becomes confusing for local school districts who have kids going out and have different experiences depending on where it is that those students are going. And I can just tell you as a legislator, as we got to June dealing with Senate Bill 767, and we went through something like 52 amendments trying to do one single thing, We needed some sort of a Rosetta Stone to help us understand what the enrollment rules were, how it all worked. And to me, that was a symptom of our need for some common ground around governance. It shouldn't have been that hard to get the words on paper to do what we've been trying to talk about doing, which was to protect currently enrolled students. I think that when the task force has completed its report and recommendations, as I said, I think that we would be mistaken to assume that this group in 2.5 months is going to be able to answer all of the questions around online schooling. I hope that we can lay the groundwork for what I anticipate will be ongoing work at the state board level, at local district levels, and of course at the legislature as well. In terms of the biggest challenges to the group completing its task, I see a couple. One, several people have already mentioned it, strongly held feelings. There's a lot of history around this task force and the bill that it came from, and I think the challenge of everybody letting go of what's been the past and moving forward, thoughtful conversation, deliberative conversation, and finding a way to really grapple with those without making
assumptions about one another based either on things we've said in the past or people that we're associated with have said in the past or positions that we happen to hold today. I think the second this came up for me today is the issue of equity. Mm-hmm. And I think that the word equity itself is really challenging. When I was a school board member, we wrestled with this and we actually put together a committee that we called the Equity Committee. I would never agree to serve on an equity committee again. The Equity Committee met for a year and a half and we never were able to define what equity was. For example, not every student can play football. Maybe they're female, maybe they have a disability, but that doesn't mean that we don't have football teams. And how do you figure out what that tension is? Not every student benefits from Title I services, but that doesn't mean that we don't offer those services in one place or another. But it's a spectrum of how do you get there. So I think we're going to be challenged to figure out how do you answer that question of equity. If we want equity of access, what does that mean? And I think that the third challenge is... I think that the way that we need to be looking at this is not promoting online learning, expanding online learning. We need to be looking at expanding student achievement and what can we do to help more students achieve and move forward and have access to a high-quality education. And online learning is one of the tools that we have at our disposal. And it's really hard for us to figure out how to use and deploy new tools and adapt to new tools when we are struggling to maintain a system that is grossly underfunded right now. Senator Morse, in our local town halls, frequently talks about the actual number of the school funding number, the K-12 spending per student is lower in actual dollars than it was in the mid-1990s. And I think that naturally causes all of us to hunker down. And when you're hunkered down and you're trying to hold on, it's really hard to look forward and also try to expand. And I think that we have to find a way to balance both the need to hold on to what we have and to make sure that we're doing the best that we can for all of our students. Time commitment. I get this bill in February in my committee, and I have learned that it is important to pay attention to this issue, be very engaged in it from the very beginning. So I will be.
Okay. I guess I'm the last one. I'll try to answer each of the questions. The issues that are most important, I think there have been a lot of questions asked that we're being asked to address by the bill itself. I think also that the Board of Education has done a lot of good work on this and that we should be looking at those questions also. I think the questions that are around the quality of the program that is available to students are probably the most crucial questions. I think secondary to that, and I want to emphasize secondary to that, is the issues around accountability. I'm most concerned with the quality of the programs that are being offered. I think as we look forward at the issues that need to be addressed, given our time frame, we are going to have to prioritize those issues that this group can actually address within the time frame we have, the issues that are most important. Obviously, understanding that others in the future are going to have to address some of the other issues, and that there may be issues out there that you actually don't need to address, that will resolve themselves as time goes forward. In terms of what would I hope that the task force has completed, its report and recommendations, what they should ultimately hope to achieve, I think a broad platform in the sense of what the standards are for virtual charter schools. There may be some of the work, there's some of the work we've already done that do impact brick and mortar charter schools. And I don't think we should be hesitant to ask the broader question about the role of virtual and distance learning broadly in public schools. The bill actually opens that door, and I don't think we should close that door. In putting all these standards together, I would hope that we would not actually create standards that are so onerous that they diminish the opportunities for students in this state, but they actually expand the opportunities for students in this state. What is one of the biggest challenges? I think Senator Morse identified it, but I might identify it a little bit differently, and that is fear. Fear of change. It doesn't matter who the party is, but everyone fears change. Senator Morse, I think, was right on an issue, right on a lot of issues, but right at the end of the session, totally dissimilar issue, that it was time to change our standard for our tax credit for windmills, basically. And you can very much see that the parties that were recipients of that tax credit were very fearful of any change. And that is actually kind of, it's kind of what the legislature, every time somebody utters anything about wanting to change anything from the status quo, what they're usually met with is fear of that change. I'm willing to devote whatever time this next 3 months will take, and may take a little bit longer than that, to be frank. We will be back in session in February. I'm hoping that we have a good product put before the legislature. I'm hoping that we have a product that will be broadly supported by all of the parties that have been involved in this discussion. I'm not saying that everybody is going to be pleased with the product, but some of the best products that have come out of the legislature have been products where everybody is a little bit displeased, but has a little bit of pleasure in what was finally produced, because that usually means a good sign that you've got what is a reasonable compromise that's fulfilling the public purpose. I think this has been a very interesting discussion. I also think this is making myself the least remarkable of this group, but this is a remarkable group of individuals that has been put together. I would congratulate the two presiding officers on deciding on these appointments, because I think the discussion here has been of a very high quality. With that, I think we do have one housekeeping issue that has to be addressed.
It's so mundane following up on all of your great observations, but some of the providers that came at lunch brought, at our request, the scope and sequence of their courses. If you didn't get kind of a thick binder from Orca with a laminated front, those are available. And Orva's brought down big old binders. I hope each of you will bring, because they've been brought and provided for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And with that, Co-Chair Gelzer, do you have anything to add?
Yeah.
Okay. We will probably be in contact with all of you relatively soon.
I'm sure we'll be.
Don't tell them that. They won't answer their phone.
Yeah, we'll stop, Mr. Chair.